Case number 09-7051. District of Columbia, a municipal corporation appellant versus John A. Strauss et al. Mr. Schifferle for the appellant, Ms. Neelums for the appellees, John Strauss et al., and Mr. Ford for the amicus curiae.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Carl Schifferle for the District of Columbia. I would like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal. The D.C. Public Schools was a prevailing party for three reasons. First, the hearing officer dismissed with prejudice the complaint, and that operates as an adjudication on the merits. Second, in its analysis, the hearing officer's determination ruled on the merits, not just mootness. And third, even assuming the complaint was moot in all respects, Mr. Strauss continued to litigate it and was only stopped.
Let's start with your second point, okay? He said the only issue before him was the failure to conduct the evaluation, right? And then when he got to the dictum that you say is a ruling on the merits, he says the facts of this case suggest that even if they had not authorized. I mean, there's no holding there at all.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the dismissal with prejudice does reflect, we believe, a holding.
Okay, well, let's talk about that for a minute. Suppose the facts were just slightly different here. Suppose that once the lawyer for the parents learned that DCPS had authorized the independent evaluation, he had asked the hearing officer to dismiss the case as moot. And the hearing officer had entered an order, the same one he did here, saying dismissed for mootness. Would you be the prevailing party?
No, Your Honor. If at the time, for example, at the pre-hearing conference where Mr. Strauss was aware of the authorization for
the evaluation. No. Just stick with my hypothetical, okay? Would DCPS be a prevailing party under those circumstances?
If I understand the circumstances correctly, if he asks that the case be dismissed at the time that he learns that it is moot, then DCPS does not contend that it was a prevailing party.
So what's the difference between the two cases?
Because in this case, Mr. Strauss continued to litigate.
But you don't get to that if you're not a prevailing party, right? In other words, if you're not a prevailing party, then it doesn't make any difference, at least under Part 2, how the lawyer behaved after the case was dismissed. You have to first be a prevailing party before you get to any question at all about the lawyer's behavior. That's what the section says. It says you can grant fees to a prevailing party who is a local education agency against the attorney of a parent who files a complaint. But first you have to be a prevailing party.
Yes, Your
Honor. And if you're not a prevailing party in my hypothetical, you're not a prevailing party here.
Yes,
right?
But we respectfully say, as I said, there are three reasons why the
district. Oh, so we're finished with that one? So,
well, no, Your Honor.
Do you agree with me or not?
Perhaps I'm just not understanding correctly.
Let me
agree, yes, DCPS does need to show that
it's a prevailing party. And if you're not a prevailing party under my the hypothetical I gave you, I don't see how you can be a prevailing party here, because the subsequent behavior of the lawyer is not related to whether or not DCPS is a prevailing party.
It is related, Your Honor, because he continued to litigate the complaint and seek relief upon the complaint.
But you don't get to that unless DCPS is a prevailing party. That's what subsection 2 says. You only get fees, only a prevailing party can get the fee if the lawyer behaves badly. So you first have the antecedent requirement of being a prevailing party.
Yes, Your Honor, and that it's the decision that confers prevailing party status. That decision would never have been reached if Mr. Strauss, knowing that the complaint has moot, simply dismissed the complaint. But he didn't do so. He proceeded to a hearing. That hearing was held on the merits of the complaint, and the hearing officer issued a decision, which you can look at in several respects. As I said, it's a dismissal with prejudice, so that confers prevailing party status. It's a decision which did reach and rule on the merits, and as in Jepson, even if mootness was a component of the decision.
Well, Jepson doesn't help you, because in Jepson, there was an actual ruling on the merits in that case. Jepson's very different from this case.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The Jepson is equivalent. There was a ruling on, in fact, the district court specifically dismissed the action for lack of jurisdiction as moot. There was a component of the decision that did reach the merits.
There was but not here. As I pointed out to you, the hearing officer here didn't resolve any questions of the merits. He just suggested that if there hadn't been an independent evaluation, then a certain result would follow. But I don't think anybody would view that as a holding. It wasn't. He didn't even say it was.
He said the complaint was filed without foundation. I think that is a holding on the merits of the complaint.
Yeah.
He did say, although...
Wait a minute. He didn't dismiss it on that ground. He dismissed it on the ground that it was moot.
Moot, right.
Anything about the merits of it is just dicta. It's not a holding.
Well, again, Your Honor, he dismissed it with prejudice. And so that, we respectfully suggest, is the holding, that confers res judicata effect to that decision. So therefore, since that decision is now final...
Well, you're putting another dog on the table at this point. That's not because of anything he said about the merits. It's because he's dismissed it at moot with prejudice.
He dismissed it with prejudice. There was a discussion of mootness. There was a discussion of no educational harm. There was a discussion in the opinion, in the decision, about the complaint being filed without foundation. But the ultimate order of this ultimate order at the conclusion was a dismissal with prejudice.
On the ground that it's moot. It's true, that bars any other claims arising out of those facts that might have been brought. It doesn't resolve those claims, it bars them.
It bars any claim that would arise out of the complaint. And any future proceeding where Mr. Strauss or on behalf of his client attempted to litigate that same claim, he would be barred by virtue of this order. And again, the orders, it simply states that order that the complaint is dismissed with prejudice. There's no qualification as moot or anything like that.
But he preceded that discussion. He said that petitioner would have faced an uphill burden. I mean, that's suggesting that if we got to this dispute, it would have been tough for him.
The counterfactual subjunctive.
You know, would have faced.
I recognize that introduction, Your Honor, but as you continue through the opinion...
That's what introductions are for, right?
So.
They describe the circumstances under which the following discussion is to be considered.
But I don't think you can necessarily assume that whatever follows that transitional introduction...
He uses the phrases suggests, would have,
But then, Your Honor, at the conclusion of that paragraph, he states, thus, between June 5th, when the psychiatric evaluation was ordered, and August 15th, when the complaint was filed, petitioner suffered no educational harm, and specifically cites in a footnote this court's decision in Lezesny. That statement is unequivocal, doesn't suggest his holding is in any sense just dicta, and in fact, if you construe that language with the final order in the decision ordering that the complaint is dismissed with prejudice, I think if we're going to interpret the hearing officer's decision, then that language suggests that it is a ruling on the merits, both not only because he actually reached the merits in the course of the decision, but by the operation of a dismissal with prejudice. That is an adjudication on merits as a matter of law. If Mr. Strauss believed that was incorrect, he could have appealed, challenged that decision. He did not. And as a result, by statute, that decision is final. And that res judicata effect, we believe, confers prevailing party status because it does change in a material way the relationship of the parties, as Buchanan established the test for prevailing party status, at least for plaintiffs.
I want to ask you about your argument about subsection 3. That is, it prevailing in subsection 3 means something different than it does in subsection 2?
Yes.
Do you agree that that argument wasn't raised in the district court?
Your Honor, I would say we did raise it, and I would say specifically why. We did argue that subparagraph 3 is different from subparagraph
2. You argued that in the district court?
Different because broader?
Different because it relied upon Rule 11. It was based
upon... Where did you argue that in the district court?
Your Honor, I have our motion for summary judgment at pages 19 to 20. Uh-huh. We quoted from the legislative history that the basis for subparagraph 3 is
Rule 11. Right, but did you argue that prevailing meant something different under 3 than it did under 2? And you only cited 2, right, in your complaint?
That's correct.
The complaint only cites 2.
That's correct.
What I'm getting at is, are you relying on the, is your position that yes, you did argue it in the district court, or are you relying on the argument you make here that the parents, the lawyers have essentially waived the waiver by not arguing that it was waived? Which are you relying on?
Waiver is our first argument.
That's your first argument. Well,
the alternative. Uh-huh.
But they do point out that it wasn't raised.
I'm sorry, they do point out?
They do point out that your argument was not raised in the district court. I mean, why else would they do that?
In an offhand way, but then they don't argue forfeiture, they don't argue waiver, they uh-huh. proceed to address it on the merits, and so for that.
I mean, why else would they point it? So do you have a case which says that in order to avoid a waiver, that you have to actually use the magic words that this argument was A, not raised in the district court, and B, therefore waived? Do we have any cases that say that?
Well, I think it would be the same way you would preserve any argument in this court, not just by an offhand reference.
I mean, the only case you cite is Fox, and that was a case where there was no mention made at all of whether the argument was raised below. So Fox doesn't help you.
I agree, Your Honor. I don't have a specific case in mind. Like I said, it would be the general principle.
Okay. That's your major argument, right? So if we don't agree with that, if we don't think the waiver's waived, then this argument's really not properly before us, correct?
Well, as I said, in the alternative, perhaps Your Honor disagrees, but uh-huh. I do believe that we raised the argument below. And when the district court sua sponte entered summary judgment against the district without a motion for summary judgment from the plaintiff, I think that has to be taken into account as far as what the district was able to argue and present. We had no notice that the court was going to enter summary judgment against us. And so the arguments we're making are based upon not an analysis offered by the plaintiff.
But your complaint, but you agree your complaint only sought fees under sub 2, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Right.
But looking at your, or turning to your summary judgment papers, when you referred to subparagraph 3, it was in connection with bad faith and improper purpose, right?
That's correct. We noted the distinction, I believe, between subparagraph 2 and subparagraph 3 by noting that subparagraph 3 was based on Rule 11 and incorporated the bad faith exception to the American rule, the court's inherent power to impose sanctions and award fees.
But
anything about prevailing being different? I don't think so.
No, I would say no, Your Honor, but certainly under Rule 11, under this court's inherent power to impose sanctions for bad faith, that is a different base. It doesn't require a prevailing party. It just requires.
District court didn't seem to think this was raised either, right?
The district court did not address
right,
it at
exactly,
all.
Right, exactly.
But as I said, we believe that was an error
Seek reconsideration? Did you point out that you had made an argument that wasn't addressed by the district court?
No, Your Honor, we did not move for reconsideration. I don't believe that we were required to.
No, you're not. But if you had an argument that didn't just occur to you last week, it seems you might have wanted to get the district court to resolve it, but okay, be that as it may.
And then I would return then to the first argument that we made as far as the prevailing party status under subparagraph 2, the provision for frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation. And we believe that we were a prevailing party under this particular provision. As I said, there is a dismissal with prejudice that operates as an adjudication of the merits. As the Seventh Circuit explained in the Riviera case that we cited, you don't look beyond the dismissal. Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to save my remaining time.
Sure.
Okay.
May it please the court. Roxanne Ellums on behalf of the appellees, Mr. John Strauss, and the law firms of James E. Brown and Associates.
Mm-hmm.
We request that this court affirm the lower court's decision because there is no judicial declaration that the district can point to that would demonstrate he prevailed at the district court at the administrative level. The actual dismissal was based upon mootness. In accordance with the mootness doctrine, if a matter in a dispute has already been resolved, there's no actual controversy which would be affected by a judicial decision. So the fact that the hearing officer dismissed the case with prejudice, anything after the hearing officer's determination that the case was moot is, as this court stated earlier, just dictum. And so the res judicata does not attach because lack of jurisdiction issues are not considered adjudication on the merits.
So should it not have been dismissed with prejudice? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, Your Honor. The fact that the hearing officer said dismissed with prejudice absolutely lends nothing to the decision. It was based on mootness, and the hearing officer said that several times throughout the proceedings. I believe he stated that he believed that the proceedings were terminated as moot. He said that because the district had provided the parent with the relief she sought, the case was moot. And as you noted, he said that his suggestions were that the parent would have a difficult time proving that the child suffered any educational harm. So there was no adjudication on the merits in this case. We also believe that Buckhannon clearly outlined that if a defendant voluntarily changes his conduct through the course of litigation and the prevailing plaintiff cannot be seen as a prevailing party. And when a defendant voluntarily changes his conduct, it lacks the necessary judicial imprimatur to confer prevailing party status. So likewise, in this situation, the district mooted the actions complained of by the parent. And so if the plaintiff cannot be a prevailing party, the defendant surely can't be one either. With regards to the district arguing that Mr. Strauss continued to litigate in a frivolous manner, we believe that Mr. Strauss, at the time of litigation, believed that the only matter that was moot before the court was the receipt of the offer of the district's psychiatric telling the parent to go and get it on his own.
When you say that, are you addressing the argument that you said was not preserved here?
No, Your Honor. I'm addressing the subsection 2 of the argument where the district states that Mr. Strauss continued to litigate in a manner that was frivolous.
Do you think that, under your theory, is that even relevant to this case?
No, it would not be, Your Honor. It's not relevant.
You don't
all.
Need to address it.
No, there's no need to address
hearing,
it.
At the hearing before the Mr. Banks, it seems that the only it seems to me that the colloquy between Banks and Strauss results in Strauss's acknowledging that the only reason that he's there is to try to generate attorney's fees.
Well, I think that the court has to also consider that with the proposed offer forwarded by
that was not an offer. That's the silliest thing I've heard in this case. I don't know how Strauss went. The record doesn't show that he had a straight face. he obviously had a lot of trouble articulating what his grievance was. But that letter is so blatantly not an offer, but an acquiescence in all the relief that was, or the substance of the relief that was requested. I'm not surprised that Banks lost some patience with him. So let's just say he got a letter saying, okay, you wanted an evaluation, you're right, get the evaluation, we'll pay for it. Not an offer of settlement, it's acquiescence. Then they go in and move to dismiss the case on the ground that it's moot.
Well, I think there were some concerns with the letter, Your Honor, because the letter stated that DCPS would reimburse for documented fees. And I think that the court has to recognize that the nature of the evaluation being sought has to be performed by a medical doctor. And reimbursement typically means that someone would have to put forth funds first and then provide documentation and be reimbursed back. And
is that what Mr. Strauss was talking about at the hearing? I see him talking about attorney's fees, but I don't see anything about that.
Well, I think.
Missing it?
Well, he also, this is not a part of the record, but he also mentioned that he has some concerns about the letter because it did not, it was not penned by opposing counsel. And so there was
now that's really frivolous, right? That came from the chancellor's office.
Yes, Your Honor.
As Banks pointed out. But was there anything in there about, well, reimbursement isn't good enough, we want them to front the money?
Well, the letter itself.
No, in the hearing.
No, Your Honor.
So he didn't go to the hearing because and treat the letter as a mere offer of settlement because it didn't propose to front the money. He didn't say that.
No, that's not a part of the record, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's put that aside. So going to a hearing, why was that not frivolous when he'd already gotten all the relief that he would ask for?
Well, I think that's what the court has to recognize. Mr. Strauss did not see this letter as offering him with everything that he sought. He
Other than
wanted,
attorney's fees, what did he not get?
Hadn't he sought some declaratory relief as well?
Yes, he sought a denial of FAPE for the district's failure to complete the evaluation, and he also sought an IEP meeting to review the evaluation and, if necessary, review and revise the IEP.
Right, well, until you have the evaluation, you don't get to that stage, right? If you get the evaluation, that begins the train of, or should begin the train of events that he wanted.
What Mr. Strauss sought to do in his complaint was reserve his right to compensatory education. And in order for him to have a bite at compensatory education, he would have had to have a finding of a denial of FAPE. So Mr. Strauss' decision to move forward was based on there were several things that were left outside of the letter, notwithstanding.
Where did he say that in the hearing?
With regards to
any of this?
He doesn't say any of that, but his complaint is sign enough that these are additional items that he was requesting. And I want to point out that Mr. Strauss tried to inform the court that any discussion regarding this letter should have been kept out.
Tried at the hearing, you mean?
At this point, there is no discussion about the additional relief that Mr. Strauss sought, but I think that would go to the tone and the tenor of the hearing, Your Honors.
The only thing I can find in which he talks about the insufficiency of the letter is this. Banks, I want to know what's wrong with this letter. Strauss, well, I mean that it's taken as an offer to settle, in which case, you know, and you rejected it because, says Banks. Strauss, well, my client does have a right to representation. There should be something with respect to attorney's fees. Banks, okay, that's your position. This is insufficient because it didn't authorize attorney's fees. Strauss, right.
I think with regards to a settlement agreement, it's the right of the client to accept or reject that offer. And the parent was here at this hearing with Mr. Strauss, so she was fully aware that, one, this offer or proposed offer did not provide all the relief that the parent sought, among that fees as well. And this parent being present in the room, she knew that this had been rejected. And so...
I'm sorry, that what had been rejected?
That this particular offer had been rejected, that it did not contain fees, it did not contain an IEP meeting or the right to review the psychiatric after...
I don't know what she knew. The record shows that he says this is about attorney's fees.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think that the tone and the tenor of the hearing would suggest that perhaps Mr. Strauss might not have been up to speed with what should have been said. And I don't know if the court should focus so much on the fact that these are the things that he didn't say. He requested this information in as relief inside of his hearing request. The district only provided the evaluation after Mr. Strauss filed his complaint, and that's noted where the hearing officer points out the district is sitting in a room that has a unit set up where they're waiting for these complaints to come across so they can mitigate their damages. So
sounds like a good thing.
I think it would.
Right, they're trying to mitigate the damage to the complainant and to their own fisc.
Well, I think it would be a greater thing if they would just comply with the law prior to a parent seeking legal competent counsel.
If they've overlooked something and the attorney calls it to their attention and they say, you're right, we'll get right on it.
Well, I'm not sure in this case that it was overlooked. Mr. Strauss forwarded the request for the psychiatric on May 14, 2008 to not only SpenGuard, but also to the very office that provided him with the letter telling the parent to go and get the evaluation. So the district knew as early as May 15, 2008 that this child required a psychiatric. They further agreed to complete it at a June 5th meeting. So this is necessarily not an instance where someone just forgot or the psychiatric slipped through the cracks. Everyone was well aware that this child required this evaluation.
Further questions?
No.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Allen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The interest of the amicus in this case is making certain that the court's holding doesn't effectively deny parents their ability to use the key enforcement mechanism under the Act.
Which is what?
Which is the ability to bring an administrative complaint of this sort.
If the situation is that bringing a complaint that is immediately vindicated means no attorney's fees or they have to pay the attorney something, is that effectively denying them the relief?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, to the extent they're mitigating immediately, that's a good thing. It would have been better to do it earlier. But what they're getting for that is then the parent is not a prevailing party, and the parent can't recover attorney's fees there. It doesn't follow from that the district ought to be able to recover attorney's fees. That's a sort of double counting, I think.
Well, if that were the end of the matter, I see your point. But then if the attorney persists in seeking attorney's fees for the incremental time after the full relief has been offered, why wouldn't that fall afoul of the statute?
Well, that's not what they're seeking in this case. They're seeking $1,750. Most of that is not for the incremental.
I gather some ambiguity about that, but I think even you put it at 600 and some, right? So let's just think about 600 and some.
And what that was for, you know, a period of a couple of weeks where the attorney was not certain that this relief was adequate, that it addressed all of the concerns, that they would, you know, be able
to. Well, I've just had a colloquy with Ms. Nellums. I'm sure you were listening. And the attorney didn't express any concerns other than the lack of attorney's fees.
No, but I still think that subsection 2 of the Act, you know, requires that the case at that point be clearly frivolous, and I think that goes to, you know, that's an objective standard.
Subsection 3 was before us, we'd have a serious issue, right?
You know, I'm not certain that it would be an improper purpose to seek attorney's fees here. I mean, it may not be one that was legally valid if the parent wasn't a prevailing party, but I don't think it was clear necessarily to the lawyer in this case that he was not a prevailing party. I mean, he had obtained the relief. He was presumably under his complaint seeking an order that the team then meet after the assessment had been
completed. Or needlessly increasing the cost of litigation?
I'm sorry?
How about needlessly increasing the cost of litigation?
Well, if there was...
Did he ever ask the district for an attorney's fee?
No, not that I know of.
So going into a hearing and pretending there's something wrong with their settlement, as he calls it, is not needlessly prolonging the litigation?
Well, you know, I he had other relief, declaratory relief, in order that the team meet after the assessment.
He seemed to be unconcerned with that at the hearing, right?
I agree that he wasn't concerned with that at the hearing. His complaint was clearly concerned.
Isn't the point that, I mean, go back to Judge Ginsburg's question. This would be could be a problem for you under sub 3, but not under 2. Isn't your position under 2 that the DCPS is not a prevailing party, and therefore the behavior of the lawyer subsequent to that is irrelevant?
I think that's correct. I think that's also our view under subsection 3. I think the two mean the same thing.
I don't understand. Did you take a position on whether subsection 3 had been preserved as an argument?
We in our brief at, I think it's 16, said that we thought that it had been forfeited.
Okay. That it had been what?
It forfeited.
Oh, forfeited, yeah. Okay. All right.
Which is actually the correct term.
Yes.
Thank
it
you.
Is.
One of those things I picked up in my clerkship and will never, you know, forget.
you can see some of us still don't have it right.
Well, I'm greatly indebted to Judge Edwards for pointing out the distinction.
returning real quick to the district's point on dismissal with prejudice, that's not inconsistent with a dismissal for mootness. You know, as recently as a year ago, the Supreme Court, in a case where all of the parties agreed it was moot, remanded and vacated the decision below and directed the district court to dismiss with prejudice. That's a case called Arave v. Hoffman. And the effect of that would be that it would have preclusive effect for the limited purposes of the facts and the issues before the hearing officer. And here, that's limited to the facts that were themselves moot. So if they tried to bring a later case, it would itself be moot. If something had happened to undo that mootness, that would be a new case. That wouldn't be blocked by the dismissal. It may be that the hearing officer was simply wrong in that case, but, you know, asking to appeal when that appeal would effectively get your client no relief, it seems like a recipe for, you know, asking people to clog up the district court with all of these appeals for no reason.
Further questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ford.
Thank you.
Mr. Schiff, we'll have some time.
I think as Amicus acknowledges and Mr. Strauss must acknowledge that there was a preclusive effect here from the dismissal with prejudice. It's only the dismissal with prejudice that stopped Mr. Strauss from continuing to litigate. Mr. Strauss's position that it should not have been a dismissal with prejudice is an argument that they did not appeal. They did not make that argument through an appeal, and therefore that decision, that dismissal with prejudice is final. And as I was indicating before, the Riviera case out of the Seventh Circuit explains that the court should look at, not look beyond the dismissal with prejudice, not look at the content of the decision, but a dismissal with prejudice
Riviera
is sufficient.
Riviera case only helps you if you're right that this was also a ruling on the merits. because that was clearly a ruling on the merits.
Well, no, actually, Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit said the district court, and the district court was explicit that it was not reaching the merits in Riviera, that it wasn't evaluating the evidence, wasn't determining who was right or wrong. It was simply dismissing the case without reaching that, but dismissing with prejudice. And the Seventh Circuit said that dismissal with prejudice, just like a court-ordered consent decree that doesn't evaluate or the liability of a party, a defendant to a consent decree might in fact deny liability. There's no adjudication on the merits in that sense. But in Buchanan, a consent order, consent decree confers prevailing party status, and we argue a dismissal with prejudice likewise confers prevailing party status, independent of the content of the hearing officer's decision.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. Thank you all. Case is submitted.